Join Johannes, a necromancer of some little infamy, and his charismatic brother Horst in the many adventures of the Cabal Brothers every week on the Necromancer's Deathcast. From circuses to dreamlands in turn-of-the-century never-never England, author Jonathan L. Howard brings his dry wit and exceptionally clever writing to this series of the most intense and tumultuous proportions. Rise up, all ye undead, and rejoice in the wonder that is the Necromancer's Deathcast.
Welcome to the Necromancer's Deathcast, brought to you by Free Flow Rambling. This is episode 3.9, Caveat Emptor, where we are discussing the book Johannes Cabal, The Necromancer. My name is Tanzin, and I am joined by Amber.
Hello.
And Jess.
Hi.
Chapter 9. Timothy Chambers writes a book report on what he did for the weekend at the carnival, and a competition between two women comes to a head. So chapter 9, in which I go to the carnival and see stuff.
Best chapter.
Are you serious?
I love this chapter.
Do you really?
I really do.
I hate it so much.
Yeah.
We're going to have a discussion today.
It is, first of all, when I first opened this chapter, I was on the ebook and I said, I'm not reading this.
Fact.
And I turned on the audiobook and it was way easier to consume.
Yes. I had to do the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at that point, then I was totally down into it. I was all here for a whole new point of view in the universe.
Right. Huh. Okay.
Okay. What?
The narrator is a little bit...
Omniscient?
Sure. Yeah.
Omniscient, where it's like, it's not necessarily you're always in Johannes Cabal's head, right? You get a lot of the other universe outside of him.
Mm-hmm.
But typically speaking, you know, the little narrator ball eye line kind of always follows Johannes anyways. But this was a fun chapter. It was like, this kind of almost has nothing to do with Johannes. We are in a totally new voice.
Yeah. I think maybe that's why I dislike it so much.
Yeah.
Like, I had a hard time sort of positioning, okay, where is this? Who's speaking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, at certain points, it's Timothy speaking, and it's obvious that he's, you know, from the way it's written. And yeah, okay, the audiobook does help. But at the same time, I'm like, one shouldn't have to resort to an audiobook in order to understand what's going on in a book.
That's fair.
Right? So, you know, and I've seen this done before where it's like, you know, and I've said in prior chapters that I absolutely love JLH's use of character development through the way that he writes the dialogue. But at the same time, it was like at some points it was Timothy speaking and it was obvious that it was, okay, he's reading his book report. But then suddenly we're talking, I'm trying to remember, like the headmaster or whatever, like
mm-hmm.
the teachers are talking, and then there's too many voices.
Fair enough.
It's hard to sort of be like, okay, so first we're in a book report and then we're actually in the time frame in which he was present at the carnival, and then the interactions with the horror bunny.
I would say it's a little bit of a jarring twist. Typically,
I hear you like those.
Talk about the other podcast, eh? There's this writing rule that is kind of 50-50 between authors. And I find a lot of the time people recommend, say your character has an accent, say that they speak with a southern drawl or that they really roll their R's or that they have a really gruff timbre to the voice, but don't actually spell out how they change the words. Like, let your readers do that themselves in their head, rather than trying to add all these extra letters to convey accent, you know, because you're just going to annoy the flow of the text. It's easier for people to just be like, oh yeah, they speak with a southern accent, rather than you trying to add all these like Y's to the middle of words or something like that sort of a thing, you know? And I know, you know, authors are pretty much 50-50 divided, you know, half of them are like, yeah, he speaks with a Texan accent, but this is a sentence. And the other half are like, no, I'm going to add in all of these extra verbal cues into the words so that you have to try and parse through them. And I find that can be a lot more difficult to read through because then you're trying to be like, wait, what? How? What are you trying to say here? Because they're switching up the spelling, which is obviously a problem with this chapter, is when he misspells every other word, you're like, what is that supposed to be? Or even if you can tell what it's supposed to be, it just really ruins the flow. You can't just skip ahead. You know, when you're reading, you kind of take in like three or four words at a time. You're just like, boom, 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 boom. But with this, it does slow it down a lot. So I can see the annoyance in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think like for me, I feel like a hypocrite because one of my favorite authors, especially from university, was Dionne Brand. She is a feminist writer who like a poet. I feel like a hypocrite saying I don't like that sort of writing style or using the accent within or the speech pattern within the writing. But at the same time, Dion Brand's book In Another Place Not Here, for example, it's a story about an immigrant from the Caribbean, new arrival to Canada, who is going through all these challenges, like from a sociocultural perspective, and being so far from home and that feeling of awkwardness. For me, that really spoke to me because it was like the whole book was hard to read, but like her life was hard. Like she was dealing with this awkwardness of being able to not communicate. So for me, that added to the story, right? It was like, okay, it's a really challenging read because now I'm in my head trying to figure out a Caribbean accent, you know, specific to a certain country. But at the same time, she's in the story trying to figure out the Canadian culture, right? So like that, I felt like the voice added to it. Whereas here, I'm like, what does it add?
Like could add that it's a childhood voice, like it's a childlike voice. And even down to the spelling, it's childlike.
It's that awkwardness of being a kid.
Right, right. And trying to figure out how to write an impressive book report and get a good grade.
Completely misspelled. Like, what grade is this kid in? Like,
yeah.
Like, he's got vocabulary, but can't spell.
My 6-year old niece has better writing than this.
But I also think that they throw in the narrator's voice to give a break to the reader because it's not reading a child's voice the entire time.
Right.
So I think that's why they have that switch
jump
off back
to the
and forth
history,
just because it is hard to continue to maintain that level.
Palate cleanser.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Rest. Okay, now go.
It's the slice of orange at the end of the meal.
I'm not too sure how much of our audience would be aware of Homestuck. It's kind of a far away fandom from this one. I'm not too sure what the overlap would be, but the Homestuck is a webcomic. And not to get too deep into it, but essentially it's a ton of humans and monsters from another galaxy and, you know, a million other different things. They all have to communicate by DM or like instant messenger sort of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. They're very rarely within the same room as each other. They're very rarely on the same planets. So they're all like 90% of the conversations throughout the story are always done through an instant messaging thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone has their own text pattern. So like one character might just write with the regular English grammar rules. And the other one has to capitalize every single word. And the other one uses a 4 in place of all A's. And the other one uses an 8 in place of all B's. And another one uses like exclamation marks as commas and question marks as parentheses. And like, it's just like every single character has their own weird set of writing rules.
Okay.
50 to 75% of them, you can kind of just read as normal. It's pretty easy to replace the 8s and B's or the 4s and A's or the every word is capitalized, right? But every once in a while, like some of them, you're trying to read through this book or read through the webcomic and you're just like, I hate how you talk. I hate your character's rules for communication. And I hate when you're a part of the webcomic because I just cannot understand what you're saying ever.
I hate Timothy. Sorry.
So this is just one of those things. Sometimes it adds to the story and sometimes it just, I hate you.
Well, and I find it interesting. Like you say, this is your favorite chapter and it's my least favorite chapter. So like there's obviously something there for in terms of.
Yeah, I will say next chapter is probably my favorite. This one I love, but chapter 10 was pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, okay, for this is what I wrote in my notes. Right under, I dislike this chapter so very much. My question was, what age is this kid? Like he uses, though misspells, words like dulcet tones and depravity. What kid who spells this poorly, like what grade is this kid in? Because like, again, my niece who's 6 or 7 doesn't know dulcet tones and depravity.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I'm like, I'd like to believe the thought that this is all about sort of creating the character. But at the same time, there's too many. I don't know any kids who use those kind of words.
Right.
If they spell that badly. You know,
like, show it to your sister, the teacher.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Be what like, age range?
What
is this?
Age range do you think this is appropriate?
To be fair, though, in a little bit more Victorian times England, it might be a slightly more common word. You know,
true. When they're all getting married at age 12, you know,
and just
they've got university level, you know, speaking possibilities by age 10.
It might still be a little above his range, but not as much as it is
for
us.
Yeah, we are taking it out of a cultural context.
And true, true. And it is never, never England, right?
Well, so. That's another thing is that, you know, JLH kind of always has this like, well, you know what? Never, never. It's not real England. It's almost England. So yeah, they just learned that word in the second grade. Shut up.
Right.
I will say, though, that we know that he's above before middle school, though, because that's something that, you know, the end of the chapter, they said, like, oh, like, he'll get sorted out in secondary school, middle school, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So we know he pretty much has to be grade 6 or younger, which is like 12 and younger.
Sounds about right.
Right? Yeah. So he's 12 maximum.
Right.
That's all we can say.
And I guess, like, within the chapter as well, like, early on, it says, the boy laughed delightedly, and Mr. Bones speaking affectation. Like, did we just switch narrators from, I wrote here, did we just switch narrators from the brat who can't spell? Is this a report, written or oral? Because, like, Mr. Bones' affectation comes into the language as well, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm being a real jerk. I'm like, I hate this chapter. Can I tell you the 20 ways in which I hate this chapter? Try to be positive. I'm always the positive one. I always love this shit.
I think you're talking about the first time we switched to the narrator's voice for Mr. Bones. And I did ask myself, is there a deeper reason for having multiple voices for this chapter? And I think it's just a stylistic choice, to be honest. And that doesn't really...
I really don't think that it's that a brand new concept in this chapter. I think this is the most jarring time since, you know, the childhood voice is so different from... other times, but when we're normally reading, we go straight in and out of Johannes and Maleficarus and the narrator and the mayor. Like, really does always jump around a lot. It's just when you're going from one adult voice to the next adult voice, it's not quite as insane a jump.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I do like that Mr. Bones does entertain Timothy quite well. Look at me. I was 16. I'm just 16. Like that part. It was very cute.
So essentially, to really sum up this chapter, is that we've got a small kid who goes and experiences the carnival and really experiences it.
Really does.
Really does.
I kind of like the whole carnival itself is just sentient. The ghost train that he's the description of how they're speeding down, and that the doors that have a face painted on it suddenly look like they're afraid before they hit they hit the doors and go through. I really like that they do that.
And the presentation is really fantastic. And I think that's another thing. Cabal is a little bit jaded about the whole thing. He doesn't really care about his carnival, right? Like, he's here to collect souls. And as long as the carnival is doing that, he doesn't put that much thought into it. And even earlier on, when he realized he had a comment, he's like, Cabal knows what music he likes. It's not this. But on the other hand, this Calliope music was actually pretty awesome. It's like, even he is just like generally not engaging with his own carnival. But every now and again, he's like, oh, all right, that's cool. But I like to see it from the patron's point of view. And we've seen it a few times here. We had Rachel and
Ted.
Thug. Right? And there was a moment you got to walk through the carnival with them, right? And there's been, you know, maybe a handful of other moments here or there where just very briefly, quickly, you get the patron's point of view and like, ooh, ah. But it is fun to go through with like the childhood, ooh, look what it does when you're not this like boring old man like Cabal.
Well, and I think it's interesting. Okay, so from the child's perspective, like also being so young that he doesn't have all these fears and stigmas and stuff set up already, right? So like Timothy rides the train, he sees a toy rabbit, the quote unquote, the embodiment of childhood fears, horror bunny. And yeah, his statement, for I've never had a bunny as a toy and therefore cannot project my Freudian traumas onto one, you know? So it's like, okay, first of all, how does a kid know about Freud? But again, I'll get off that train for a second.
I think that's maybe trying to be the funny part about it is that because the kid does know about Freudian trauma.
Right? Like, so like he has none, but at the same time, he's aware of, you know, the condition.
I think, yeah, it's just one of those never, never England. Everyone just knows about Freud.
Yeah. He was a big deal back then.
Yeah, we're all just super aware of this guy all the time.
Right? So, but yeah, I just thought that was funny. It's like the kid doesn't even have, like, he's too young for any deep-seated fears.
You know? It's a fun concept because it's true about children, you know? Like,
totally.
You've always got, like, it's the youngest children that are, like, throwing themselves into the deepest part of water, right? And it's the children 1 or 2 years older than them that will refuse to leave the shallow end, right? Like, there's just that little bit of an age gap where kids are like, nothing can hurt me.
I am invincible. I know nothing of consequence.
Exactly.
Oh, I felt bad for that poor rat with the other toys that come, or they're drinking beer and playing cards. When they start calling out to Timothy, bet you had this when you were a kid. Bet you had this. Bet you had Cromarty the piebald rat. Bah! I had to look up what piebald meant. just in case you didn't know, it's white with black patches.
Right.
Two-tone. So Jan fixes his eyes and mentions about stereoscopic vision being messed up with a dangling eye. That made me laugh, too. Because I just had visions of it. Like,
like, I've got horrible, horrible eyesight already. And if I had to be, like, tucking my eye back into place all the time, I'd be so annoyed. Even having to wear a mask and glasses is already an annoyance.
True.
Wandering around having to tug my eye back into place of all things.
But you know what? I think I watched too much like Jim Henson and Dark Crystal as a kid because I always thought that Ogre's ability to like take her eyeball out and like, you know, raise it in the air and look around. I'm like, I want that skill. Like, I want to be able to, you know, like, and as a kid, it made sense because I'm like, well, you know, if I was in a mall and I can't find my mom, I can just like pop out my eyeball and just reach up and have a look around, you know, like I know the top of her head now. But yeah.
I have all the solutions in life and none of the abilities to execute them.
I could fix it all if I could just take my eyeballs out.
I like to, like most people are afraid to touch their eyeballs, right? And like when you learn to wear contacts, you get used to it. But like, I don't think I'd be able to like manhandle like the back of my eyeball even for that. Like, well, I've got the front covered. I don't know if I could have the rest of it in my palm.
I think, again, this is too much Jim Henson influence, but I always thought that like body parts should be like in, what is that, The Labyrinth? Where like the fiery dancers, where they like take off their arms. You don't need your arms. You got two arms, you know, and they throw their heads around. Oh. That was one of my favorite parts. Oh my God, we have to watch Labyrinth together.
It's true. I haven't seen it in a really long time.
Oh, it's my all-time favorite movie of all time. All time. Oh, all God. Time. Did I mention all time?
All time.
Jesus.
Labyrinth, yes.
I'm but, seriously questioning your taste in everything now.
Oh, stop. Jim Henson is my God. It's...
Hard blow for JLH.
No comment. JLH is a great writer. I just hate Timothy.
He would have had it in the bag if it weren't for Timothy.
You know, like he would have come close.
There's no Timothy in
come close
the
to
Labyrinth.
Jim Henson if it hadn't been for Timothy.
Damn you, Timothy.
Damn you, Timothy.
So essentially, yeah, the horror bunny or Jan is attempting to scare him and show him through the carnival, and it's not working. So I like how his eventual plan is like, all right, mirror room. And I like how Timothy is also just like, that's not scary. Because agreed, that's got to be one of the most boring parts about it. The only fun thing about a mirror room is when they're the mazes and people are just smacking into walls all the time. That's the only time a mirror room is fun.
That's a little schadenfreude there.
Those are the best mirror rooms. It's when no one can find the exit and they all just walk into mirrors. Other than that, mirror rooms are boring.
It's true. The only thing that I was wondering, though, is what do you think was in the closet for wardrobe?
Right? I'm like, we skipped ahead on that. I want to talk about the closet, you know?
Is it skeletons in the closet?
Possibly. And I thought it was funny that, like, the line, you know, a couple lines after, we should have a few vampires and zombies and that sort of thing in, shouldn't we? All the psychological stuff is entirely wasted on you. Like, they keep trying to scare him with boogeyman in the closet, and Timothy's not falling for it. And I love that the idea that Jan comes up with, the horror bunny, is, like, more zombies and vampires. I'm like, the entire carnival is made of vampires and zombies. One of the proprietors is a vampire. Like, what is the issue here? You should have this whole terrify children thing in the bag.
Like
stuff bunnies ain't going to do nothing for him. Things in the closet. These are things he's dealing with every day at home.
It's
vampires,
poor,
you know.
The poor problem when your entire carnival is meant to sign contracts with the devil. You know, everyone's trying to escape debt and divorce and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You got to go back to your roots and remember scaring children was what the foundation
what really brought
was built
us here.
On. The true foundation of our success.
Well, and it's interesting too, because like no kids, right? Like there's been, and like spoiler alert, that comes later on, but like the whole thing that like Cabal actually has rules, mm-hmm. right? Where it's like, no children. So it makes sense that like the things that have been set up to terrify are not actually going to have an effect on kids mm-hmm. if they're not the target audience, right? So
right.
The shit that makes noise in the cupboards, that's going to scare adults because, well, who knows what's in there? You know, our imaginations are more terrifying than what's actually in there most of the time. Well, unless you're at Cabal's Carnival.
Right. I just had this vision of somebody thinking, it's like hiding the cheating lover inside the closet.
Stay in the closet.
Stay there.
See, these are things adults are afraid of, not kids. Yes.
The only other thing that made me laugh, too, is those gobbling spoons. fingered pipe cleaners that come for a visit. I'm like, what are they meant to be? They're just a mess. We've been going on for months now, and I've never met anyone who has a morbid fear of surrealism.
I have a slightly morbid fear of surrealism. I'm kidding.
Do I have the carnival for you?
Yeah, right? So they are in the Hall of Mirrors. And that doesn't seem very interesting until we see a woman.
Until you're on the inverse side of it.
Exactly.
I liked how it was described, that the vision through it. It was like looking through a film of oil or a body at the bottom of a shallow pond. Mm-hmm. It's quite the dark illusion. Mm-hmm. Like that's where it kind of goes a little bit darker.
Below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
A very, very Mirror of Aracid. Harry Potter, Mirror of Desire.
Okay. I read Harry like 10 years ago.
Well.
When you were like Timothy's age.
Book one. I was Timothy's age the first time I read Harry Potter.
20 years ago then.
Yeah, there you go.
Book one. Yeah.
Point is that it shows all your deepest desires, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily a good thing to pursue.
Right.
So this was very fun to just see the whole witnessing someone else witness their desires, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it was a fun, interesting, macabre. What's that fucking word?
Macabre.
Yeah, macabre.
Yeah.
Listen. It's fine. It's going to be fine.
So you think this is the, I assumed, I mean, a spoiler, I guess, that this is the teacher is my guess.
Oh.
Interesting.
Oh.
Not at all what I thought.
Because she seemed familiar. And she's trying to get every desire that she wants. And near the end of the story, when she's talking to the headmaster, all of her desires seem to be coming true.
It's true. She wasn't smiling. Timothy squinted. She looked familiar somehow.
Now that you bring it up, I'd never made that connection before. Now I'm thinking about the end of the chapter and how it goes. Interesting.
There's your full circle right there.
Holy shit. Right. All of the strings
mind
in my head.
Blown.
Oh my God.
Tanzan, you're too smart for your own good.
Yeah, that's.
I try.
I do have to call attention to this descriptor because I actually laughed out loud and thought, I want to use this. Probably, yeah, it's she's seeing herself as she wishes she was. This is about the woman looking in the mirror that Timothy's witnessing. She's seeing herself as she wishes she was, probably a bit younger, probably a bit more shapely, probably not looking quite so much like somebody traveling steerage in the ship of life.
Yeah,
I so want to use that. Like, just, yeah, she's, yeah. She's looking like somebody traveling steerage in the ship of life.
Luckily, though, this mirror does give all the opening that Jan needed, finally.
Mm.
When he gets to turn his attention to Timothy, and it's like, well, what would you see in the mirror? And little Timmy falls for it hook, line, and sinker, just like they all do.
Space pilot.
Yeah.
This was really the most fun part of the chapter. Is when you get transferred into this whole
Bradbury-esque it's amazing universe.
Well, he jumps in and he starts using all these alien terms and all of these different
Protosaurus Rex,
hoodicky space travel terms and astronaut jobs. I don't know any of it.
It's
but it was,
fully fleshed.
It was like, fully
it is
fleshed,
not like, just like a kid's.
Yeah, no, it was like universe now. Like you're in an entire setting now.
Mm.
And I was recognizing a lot of the words that were coming up and being like, this is clearly something that Timothy has read before because I'm recognizing half the language he's using, right? And I've just been reading through Dune and I was like, is this Dune right now? Like, are we reading Dune? No, it was H.G. Wells, who, like, father of science fiction.
Yeah.
And all of his space travel astronaut alien books. That's what it was. And I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, half the terms, as far as I can tell, are JLH created. But the other half seemed to be coming from H.G. Wells' books.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it was like, you know, Timothy's little fantasy land, you know?
Right. That's a great little nod off.
Yeah, it was super cool. I was like, hey, these are like ant people, which is essentially like what he was describing was like humanoid ants walking around, right? And I'm like, that's just what you want as your crew? Like, yeah, I wouldn't be able to scare this kid either.
The moment is broken by Timothy's narration, returning to talking about girls. Ugh, yuck, spoo.
But it makes him feel a little awkward.
A little funny.
Little funny feeling in the Fruit of the Looms.
So that's a real quick thing that I do want to backtrack on, is that when we had the supposed teacher doing her whole you know, seeing all your desires or whatever like that. And Jan is like, oh, the boss is going to be late. He should have been here any second now, right? And then you get to see Cabal come out.
Mm.
And he's just, for me, it was almost like a silent movie. Like, you just see this man come out of nowhere and he offers a contract and you watch someone do it and you're standing on the other side of the glass screaming. You're like, don't do it, don't do it. And you just watch them, like, the woman sign away her soul and Cabal, you know, tips his hat and thank you very much, ma'am. Have a nice day. And for him, you know, it's just very practical. Like, just like, you know, your 5 to 9, 9 to 5 job and you just get it done and go, right? And I really liked kind of the lack of theatrics in that moment, you know? It was just like, we just watch for Cabal to come out and he gets this done and he exits stage left and he waits again for the next person to come through. Like, I really liked the simplicity of that transaction.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes it all the more fun when, you know, we come up to Timothy's transaction.
Right.
And all of a sudden, hi, Horst. You're not the right brother to be stepping out right now.
Actually, going back again to that mirror moment,
mm-hmm.
it does say that Johannes actively does not look in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me wonder what he would see if he did look in the mirror.
Mm.
I put a little joke in here, him more like Horst. Ha ha ha.
Probably not.
Ooh, don't poke that bear. But yeah, I think it's funny.
But honestly.
That is the kid. Like, so Jan asks, think you could do this for a living, being a hero and everything? And Timothy's reverie is broken briefly. He sees Layla, the latex lady, and the other stuffed animals dressed in tatty silver lame costumes. You know, so I thought that was interesting that it's all just part of the smoke and mirrors, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
that he got such a wonderful vision from it, too.
Absolutely. And it's the same characters putting on the same ruse. You know, you got Layla coming back and making everybody feel funny in the fruit of the looms.
When I brought up that We Happy Few, you know, as long as you're on the happy pills, everything is according to plan. But as soon as you're off the pill, suddenly it's all just one big act, which is, again, at its roots, that's what a carnival is about. There's even a line earlier in the book. It's like people pay to be tricked. That's
right.
Why you come to the carnival. Like, you pay for the smoke and mirrors. You're here to be deceived.
Totally.
Well, this is a nice way of looking at an example of somebody seeing what their greatest desire is, in a way. Because we don't really actually get to see from the as you said before, from the patron's point of view, mm-hmm. what it's like to be deceived by the carnival. And so this is, like, that's intense if that's what the people are going and that's what they're experiencing. Is this, like,
better than virtual reality?
Yeah. Totally, yeah.
The no kidding.
Well, this is like honestly, reading through this book, you know, I kind of had the sense that the carnival was kind of like a forever thing, right? Like, book 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, I was like, you can't have this series without the carnival. Like, this is their basis for Johannes and Horst's entire life, you know? Like, I can't see them working in any other parameters. Like, this whole thing is built for them to, right? So I remember just the first time reading this and being halfway through and them being like, okay, we're gonna, like, be done with our carnival. And I'm like, there's still, like, half a book to go through and, mm-hmm. like, 4 more books. Like, what do you mean you're almost done with the carnival, right?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's just moments like this that it's just, how can you guys do anything else?
Well, except that if you'd started with Exuant, which none of us did until the second read through, you know, you'd also realize that there's a theatrical component and, mm-hmm. you know, also a stay at home.
It is true.
Stay at home proprietor of
the short stories do let you see he lived outside of the carnival, but just having, started with the carnival book, I'm like, this is all that exists in the world.
Well, and I think that's why it is such a good start to the series in a lot of ways, right? Like, it's just, I mean, it was the first book I read and the first one that caught my interest, just because, like, who doesn't love a carnival?
Right.
Like, and so you're right, there
carnival?
Is that.
Yep.
Wait, I think those exist. Though not quite as
dark. All carnivals.
It's not quite as dark as this one, but, you know, this one has Satan's direct influence. So
going back to Horst intercepting the transaction, he yells that no children, which Johannes doesn't really think about in the slightest. Like, Johannes was just by, like, any means possible.
A soul is a soul is a soul.
Wait, doesn't Cabal break through?
No, it's Horst. Horst comes in.
Oh.
And I think this is the start of the rift starting between them, because he did say, by any means possible.
Yeah, at the start of the next chapter, they're fighting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, okay. See, I was captivated about the thing before that. A form, said Timothy dubiously. Forms were the only things about growing up that filled him with fear, and they looked complicated, and he knew his parents hated them. I love how like forms become the constant like issue. So hang on, I'm going back to this. I thought it was, for some reason I wrote down the cabal had broken through and been like, stop, no
it
children.
Says a man that looks like the blonde man that looks familiar.
Oh.
But he's got, everything happens so quickly, it has to be Horst because things happen at once. The pen magically disappears from his hand. Then he's picked up this 4-foot bunny.
Right.
Horror bunny. He's got that at the same time.
So you need Horst
saying no
speed.
Yeah, speed.
I think it's because
strength.
It says here, Mr. Cabal, say we do whatever is necessary. Say Yan.
Yeah. Speaking of Johannes, to Horst.
Okay. Okay. See, again, this is, you know.
All these brothers going by their last names. How dare?
Well, not even that. Like, it's interchangeable. Like, even in the next chapter, it's like, you know, even when you're talking about Cabal versus, or Johannes versus Horst. Johannes always tends to default to Cabal, whereas they're both Cabal.
Yeah.
Which is one of my notes here is that I'm surprised because Timothy says, he's like, oh, it occurred to me after that this must be the other Cabal bro, as in Cabal Carnival Bras.
Right.
And that's when it was like, oh, it's actually interesting to me that Horst has actually allowed his name to be a part of this thus far, because it isn't the Cabal Carnival. It is the Cabal Bros Carnival. And I was like, it actually has not occurred to me until this moment that Horst has kind of always allowed his name to be a part of this since the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
He's very conflicted. He wants to help his brother and get his brother out of trouble, but he wants to do it in the most moralistic way possible, which is next to impossible because of the nature
of... And he's a vampire,
yeah.
So, like, there's some moral gray lines there, too.
Well, it's just total contending loyalties, and, like, it's almost like the tragedy of Horace's life is that it's just, like, no matter what, he can kind of never be satisfied. Everything is at odds with his entire existence all the time, you know? And there's just a little bit of this sadness to him. It's like, you just can't be the good guy when you're the vampire.
Yeah.
And when Cabal is your brother.
Exactly. Like,
no matter
you're
how
born
hard,
into this shit,
right?
Whether you like it or not.
It's like he really, really badly wants to be the good guy, but at every turn, he's just, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
So Horst has returned Timothy to his mother and they leave the carnival. And then we get to see Miss Rain finishing up the report. We get the impression right away from the headmaster that she's prone to making a fuss over nothing, which in this case is going to be regarding Timothy's report that she's making a big fuss over nothing about.
And it's bordering on the psychotic, according to her.
But that's where things suddenly start changing.
Well, and it says, in the space of 10 minutes, Timothy Chambers stopped being a nice, decent sort of lad, if a little prone to fancies, and had become a potential serial killer, arsonist, and cannibal. Psychiatric reports were a probability, observational internment a possibility, and removal from the school a certainty.
Mm.
Yeah.
See, this just goes to show that no matter what, that even though Horst saved his soul, he didn't save the kid's well-being because there's such destruction that is a result of the carnival.
Well, that's interesting.
It's so extreme when you dance with the devil.
Yeah.
That taintedness just infects it. Yeah.
See, and I didn't even see that. I was like, that's a really extreme reaction to like a kid's, you know, report. But that makes sense, right?
You're just tainted by the carnival.
Yeah, because if she hadn't sold her soul, the headmaster would have been like, yeah, whatever. He's fine.
So I wonder what she wanted then. Because immediately after, talks about, after all, I should know, but this is Miss Rain saying, I was at the carnival myself last night. I had a wonderful time. So this supports what you were saying about it being maybe Miss Rain who was checking out the mirror while Timothy was watching with Horror Bunny, Jan. But I wonder what she asked for.
Well, I think,
Seems to have a sudden, she's gone from in the headmaster's eyes to somebody who's a little prone to histrionics to somebody who has a just cause to remove a child from...
Well, and how pretty she is.
She's suddenly prettier, too. And Jan said earlier, it's like she's probably wishing that she was a little bit more shapely, that she was a little bit younger, that she was taken a little bit more seriously.
Right.
And suddenly you've got now the... That's exactly what I was thinking when Tansen brought it up, is like, oh my gosh, like the headmaster is checking this list off for us.
Yeah.
Which is, I hate myself for not thinking of it myself.
Yeah, because it's like, as Tanner, the headmaster, leaned forward, I didn't even clue into this. He noticed that Miss Rain's skirt stopped just shy of her knees. This was a new development. Ah. So yeah, she must have just...
Yeah, he just, as it goes on, he just continues to fall under this spell.
And so she's now suddenly a little more captivating rather than riding steerage.
Yeah.
And that's another point, too, is that it's not necessarily that it's just Timmy who's been affected by this, but Miss Rain herself, who has now gone from just, you know, simple school teacher to accusator, as she inexplicably, effectively ruins Timothy's life, too.
Mm.
Yeah.
and got this mini little Ted kind of being born right now, which is super sad to think about because this was like just a chill kid, right? Like he says at the beginning, he's like, my poor mummy, I had to shackle off her love. She's way too overprotective of me and my brother Victor who hides under my bed. He just seems to be like, honest to God, like just this chill little boy, right? But by the end of it, you know, when you get that alienation, which is being very clearly set up for him now at the end of this chapter, it's like, oofed.
He's now considered psychotic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yep.
And I thought so we get to a completely different, you know, ending to the story here where we talk about from the journal of the Reverend M, Vicar of St. Kenas, Jessop Leeses, April 25th, whatever.
I love this tiny short story.
Well, and it talks of an exotic floral arrangements that were brought in by the parishioner, but all of it turns rotten. And the Reverend asks for the arrangements to be taken off the church consecrated ground. And we discover that she got the arrangements as a deal of some kind from Cabal's carnival the night before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that she actually makes the connection with consecrated ground, like that she's...
It's true.
Kind of goes, oh no, what have I done?
I brought some Satan created something to the church.
Yeah. And that she may have bitten off more than she could chew when she sold something. Like her soul.
Mm-hmm.
Like all for a floral arrangement? I would have gone higher. Like I would ask for more.
Right. Part of the issue when you don't know what the deal is for. But right? That's why I feel like it's especially one of those things. Like I said, like when you dance with the devil and you wake up with fleas, as we can clearly see through this story and as we go on further, even the souls that Cabal doesn't get to count towards his tracker are still being condemned to Satan, for example, Timothy, right? And all these other people that are just slowly, slightly infected by it, right? It's like, I feel like, you know, Satan is in the underworld. And it's like for every one soul Johannes claims, Satan's like, that's really two for me, you know?
Good point, yeah.
And if Cabal had a little bit more awareness of the situation or was a better lawyer or something like that, he could have argued for a lot more souls, I think, regardless of the form. Due to just, you know, how many people are affected overall in this story, regardless of not whether they agree to the terms.
Yeah.
But I have one last note here, which earlier on when Cabal first comes out to make the contract be signed, mm-hmm. and Timothy notes that he's dressed slightly archaically. Even Johannes is the one who's dressed slightly archaically compared to everyone else. It's just an odd note. Like, even he is just, what is slightly archaic? Like, a couple decades behind? Like, is he that anal, and even in Never Neville England, he's still a bit too properly dressed. Like, I'm just like, how does that man dressing then if even he is like slightly archaic for the times?
Well, what would you consider
dressed like an undertaker?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I already assume that they go around in like a 3-piece suit typically anyways, right? At least people who can afford her. And we know that Johannes Cabal is a little bit hoity-toity, right?
Yeah.
So, but what does his clothes look like then if he's even more...
Well, he's got a cane and he travels around with a hat.
But that's Victorian England.
Isn't that the time period, though?
Yeah.
So it was just a small note that I'm like, even
he's showing up in loincloths.
Like, yeah. Like.
Well, and I mean, that would probably be considered archaic if you're showing up to like all these country bumpkin towns.
I suppose when overalls are just a slightly more.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And this kid hasn't seen any gentlemanly wear.
Fair enough.
And I don't know enough about historical fashion to comment.
But if anyone out there does.
You know, ask me about like mid-century modern and later and I can talk to it.
Tell me about the 90s.
Oh my God, make me smack you.
You can't reach me from over there.
So going back really quickly to the consecrated ground and the rivalry between those two ladies just still makes me giggle. And I think definitely Mrs. J was definitely the smarter of the two, purchasing knowledge instead of items, because she's the one that got a book and fared much better, which was...
For now.
Yeah.
I was like, so you think. Again, what Jess was saying about tainted items.
Yeah. And then the Reverend signs off his journal with the phrase caveat emptor, which means let the buyer beware. Right. And that's the principle that the buyer alone is responsible for checking the quality and suitability of goods before a purchase is made.
Excellent. Yes. And Mrs. B left in a hurry, presumably after the fairground people, to demand her money back, although they have already moved on in the night and nobody seems to know where. I love that they're like total thieves in the night. They're like, yep, okay, did our damage here, moving on. More souls to reap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No time to waste.
No time to waste. We only got a year for Satan.
So this concludes our episode 3.9, Caveat Emptor. Thank you for listening. You can find us online at freeflowrambling.com and necromancers.ca. There we have links to our other podcasts, social media, and other fun tidbits. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing, and please consider supporting us through Patreon to keep the undead alive and to see more content. We are Free Flow Rambling, and remember, reanimation is trending.